down through the chimney comes Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry. Ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't know already, I'm Amelia Dalton, and this here is EEJournal.com's Weekly Electronic Engineering Podcast. What's in our EE grab bag this week? Yep, you guessed it. The technology of the future. And the future's future. And the future's future's future. I'm pretty sure. HLS. Yes. And for those of you not yet in the Cool Kids Club, what I'm talking about here is high-level synthesis. Today we're talking about IP collaboration, the ongoing battle between the languages, that's C, C++, and System C, of course, and the details of Catapult's new architecture, and much more with Mark Milligan of Calypto Design Systems. Come on, let's get our HLS on. Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, it's great to be back.
So, Mark, let's first talk a little bit about the history of HLS, just a bit. Now, I have always heard that HLS is the technology of the future and always will be. Now, Mark, could that future be now? And tell my audience how you've seen the adoption of HLS grow over the years.
Yeah, well, we've been on a trajectory of growth with high-level synthesis. And if you go back all the way back to the late 90s with Synopsys doing the first generation of behavioral compiler, which kind of went away and most of those capabilities merged into regular design compiler because it didn't have a lot of value on top of what was normally being done at the RTL. But really, in around 2004 with Catapult and some other products in the industry, we really hit a generation two of high-level synthesis, which was really big. First, it adopted higher-level languages like C++ and System C and really raised the level of abstraction, giving a lot greater design productivity. And they also had great technologies under there for what we call top-down optimization. So they produced great results on certain types of IP that was comparable to what you do if you designed by hand at RTL. And they absolutely crushed it in terms of design time, big productivity gains. So that's where we've been since around 2004. And there's been some limiting factors fitting into the design flow that really prevented it from going more widespread.
So what do you think those factors are?
Yeah, there were really a couple of them. One is fitting into the design flow for reaching design closure. And the second one was fitting into RTL verification methodologies, both really crucial. For design closure, all the Generation 2 tools kind of assumed a top-down methodology that was very similar to what you do with a software compiler. So, you know, write your C code or your System C, compile the design, get the RTL out, and you're good to go. And as I said, it had great results. But unfortunately, that's with deep submicron designs, advanced silicon technologies, design closure is pretty tough, and the designs are also, the subsystems are getting very, very big. You know, millions of gates. The way people really work with hardware design is they need to take this huge design and partition it and carve it up, and then they go through RTL synthesis, maybe place and route, and lock down groups of the design. And so now if you need to go back and make a change with the Generation 2 tools, then you go back and change, you recompile the design, now you've got different RTL and different hierarchy. So that was one big challenge for how do you get to design closure when you're trying to work both top-down and bottom-up. And that required a new architecture. And what we've done with our new Catapult 8 is we've launched a new architecture for high-level synthesis that we believe is the third generation high-level synthesis that provides the control engineers need to reach design closure. Because top-down only was insufficient for dealing with these complex designs. You needed both top-down and bottom-up. On the verification side, verification's come a long way, although we're still using RTL as the predominant verification level, and then, of course, FPGA prototyping and emulation to help do system-level verification. But for RTL verification, methodologies like UVM have grown up that kind of assume you wrote that RTL code yourself, meaning the tools will help identify where there's coverage problems and then assume you need to go write a test to cover that part of the code. With high-level synthesis, that RTL is automatically generated. That also required a change in high-level synthesis tools. So what we do now with Catapult 8 is we actually produce verification-optimized RTL. And that means that you want to do your functional verification at the high level where you can get 1,000 times speed up, so you get a lot of functional verification done at the C level. And then after synthesis, the RTL verification tools, you want to have that automated as much as possible. And so by creating verification-optimized RTL, it's a much more efficient process, and you can kind of run through that RTL verification as a more of a checkbox to make sure your structural coverage is adequate.
Okay, Mark, let's talk about the design teams adopting HLS. Now, do you think this has changed over time? And which design teams are you seeing being new adopters to HLS?
Yeah, it's definitely growing a lot. And these types of designs that have a lot of algorithmic content or have a strong time to market and change component have really gravitated to high-level synthesis. Because as I said, you can get comparable quality results, but you can do it much, much, much faster. And so designs like a video and image processing or advanced communication designs that have a lot of algorithmic content to them, you want to be able to take that coded in C or system C, check it out, simulation, and verify that the image algorithm is working properly, for example, and then you want to synthesize it and get it into silicon as quickly as possible. And that those types of designs have been sort of the first adoption of high-level synthesis. And, of course, there's lots of image processing and a lot of video applications going on these days and advanced communications that have a lot of Fourier transforms and a lot of filtering going on. And these things have been very effective for high-level synthesis. But now it's some of these barriers to adoption around design closure and verification and a couple other factors that we should talk about have been addressed. We see this as growing and broadening out for the types of IP subsystems that are being addressed.
So I'm interested in this trend toward IP distributed in C++ or System C forms. What are the advantages here, do you think?
Yeah, it really comes down to collaboration. And being able to code the IP blocks at a C level, it's much clearer. It's right, much more compact code. It doesn't include some of the technical details about the physical implementation and doesn't even necessarily dictate which microarchitecture would be used in the implementation path. So it's technology independent, and it's also more compact code. But that means that it's easier to read and easier to share and easier for somebody else to pick up. And then reuse part comes in because it's more technology independent. When you go into the synthesis and target it, you know what technology library you're targeting. You can then make the right microarchitecture decisions and get the best power, performance, and area for that technology library. And that power part's a really important aspect here because one microarchitecture might be the best power solution for a given library, but then you go to the next technology node and it actually may not be the lowest power implementation. So if you have a coding that is independent of that, you're able to quickly retarget, just simply change your constraints or maybe change some lines of high-level code and produce a more optimal, lower power result. So then, but take it back to your question about collaboration. Those are kind of the benefits. And when you're talking about collaboration and distributing IP, the idea there is you want to be able to let the user pick the library, pick the microarchitecture, and do the synthesis, number one. And number two, if it's collaboration, where you want to have one design group actually make some improvements to the code and then pass that back to the high-level code, then back to the source code that all the users can share, that's very difficult to do at the RTL level because more than likely those changes that they made were technology-dependent changes, and then how do you merge that back and how does somebody else use those changes becomes very problematic. So this is the approach that, for example, Google took with the VP9 online video, the web video acceleration IP that they distribute to their partners, Silicon Partners, and they wanted to have a model that they could provide that IP in C code to their silicon partners who could then modify it, get the best implementation, but then also feedback changes back to the source, and that's their vision of collaborating. The interesting thing is not everybody has this mode of distributing their source code to their partners and then wanting to take their partners' improvements and feed it back in, but certainly people have the vision of wanting to share their IP internally and get the maximum amount of reuse. So the idea of moving to a C level for your IP development internally can also help design teams within the company, A, understand what the code is, and B, implement it using high-level synthesis and get the best power performance area because that IP is being shared in a technology-independent fashion. And I think it's power that's really driving that because we have one big SoC company, the customer is actually recoding all their video IP in their company in high-level synthesis because of this retargeting from one technology generation to another. The reuse is so much more powerful if they've done it using C and then have the individual design teams implement from there.
All right, Mark, let's talk a little bit about the ongoing battle over languages. Now, where does Catapult fit in this struggle?
Yeah, back in that generation two, around 2004, some HLS technologies had picked System C and some picked C++. And as a result of that, there's been a little bit of a language war. Which one should we use? Which one's better for high-level synthesis? And the reality is, you can use either one. There are some technical differences between the two that might drive you to select one or the other. By and large, it's really driven more about the overall design flow. What are your architects using? Do you have algorithm developers developing in MATLAB or C anyway, and you want to connect the hardware team to them? Or are you doing a virtual platform for software development that you might steer you towards a System C approach? So there's kind of a big picture design flow things that will drive people, and then there's some smaller technical differences between the two that may want you to pick one or the other. But the net effect has been people have been concerned. You know, it's back like the VHDL and Verilog wars many years ago. Which one is right? Which one's going to win? And reality is both were suitable for certain types of applications, and people use both from an industry perspective. With the Catapult 8, what we've done is created a native dual language architecture that lets project teams pick which language do they want to use, and it's really up to them. So they can pick what's best for them in their design flow, technical decisions about what's best for their particular application, but they can use the same tool for either one. And we see companies now using both, not necessarily within the same project, but different projects using different languages within the same company.
All right, Mark, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, Mark, I know you're a bit of a Colorado Buffaloes fan. Is that right?
That's right.
And last time I checked, their football team wasn't doing so hot. So, Mark, any insight onto that? What's going on there?
Well, hey, we're on the right track. How about that? We've made some big improvement from last year, and the wins didn't come, but we're making big progress. And hey, it's basketball season, and the Colorado basketball team does great.
There you go. It's always time for basketball season. Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me, Mark. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, it's so much fun. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, how does that saying go? A way to a woman's heart is through her ear? Wait, no, that's wrong. Anyway, in this week's Kickstarter Corner, when a Fitbit on your wrist just isn't fashionable enough, let me introduce you to the EarOSmart, brought to you by Biosensive Technologies. This functional and fashionable earring will not only measure your activity level, your heart rate, and your calorie count, but also looks fabulous. So now, really, what more could you want? All right, so let's break down this Kickstarter Corner Vital Signs fashion accessory, shall we? It's got two ICs on board, a TI-AFE 4400 and a CC2541. That handles the Bluetooth part. Okay, it also uses PPG or photoplethysmogram, ouch, I think I got that right, technology to monitor your pulse through the blood flow in your skin. Okay, cool. And the whole darn thing measures only 16 millimeters in diameter. Okay, now how exactly did they get all the sensors and the power source and the ICs all in such a tiny size? Three stacked PCBs, of course. One contains the coin cell battery, another has that CC2541 and an antenna, and the third contains the AFE 4400 and the sensors. Oh yeah, and all EarOSmarts come with a surgical steel post, of course. All right, price. All right, so what if you're saying to yourself right at this very minute, Amelia, I would love to make you a pair of smart earrings. What's the bottom line? Well, it's going to cost you around $180. That will get you a set of EeroSmart PCBs, but it will also provide you with access to video training modules explaining how to get your fitness tracker earrings up and running. Get it? Running? Okay, sorry. Now, according to their Kickstarter page, it looks like their timeline runs until June 2015 for an estimated shipping date for these kits. So, I guess I'll just take a rain check for now. If you want to check out more information about EeroSmart, I've included a link below the player that will take you directly to their Kickstarter campaign. And my favorite color is green, just FYI. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And hey, if Google Plus is your thing, you can join our circle on Google Plus as well. We also have a YouTube channel, keyword EE Journal, that is full of all kinds of techie videos, our very own Chalk Talk webcast series, and our video series called On the Scene. Also, by clicking those links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page, you can grab our Fish Fryin' RSS feed or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Fryin' page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or perhaps the best geeky hotspot in your hometown, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of December 5th, 2014, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.